Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. 50 years ago today, boxer Muhammad Ali faced challenger Ernie Terrell for 15 rounds, culminating in a unanimous win for the champ. In a few weeks, Ali was stripped of his championship, his boxing license, and his passport. He had refused to be drafted for service in Vietnam. Randy Roberts is co-author of Blood Brothers, The Fatal Friendship Between Muhammad Ali and Malcolm X. He teaches history at Purdue University, and he joins us now from West Lafayette. Randy Roberts, welcome to In the Moment.
Hi, Lori. It's nice to be here.
A historic day, as we remember, 50 years ago. Can you put that fight into context first, as for where it fell in Ali's career itself? How old is he? Where is he at in his boxing career?
Wow, it's hard to imagine. It's been 50 years, but I guess it has been. Well, Ali won the heavyweight title in 1964 when he defeated Sonny Liston in February of 1964. And, you know, he was controversial from the very beginning. But initially people thought, well, he just bragged too much. He talked too loud. He belittled opponents too much. But then suddenly he became involved with the Nation of Islam, which was viewed at the time as an anti-American hate group, an anti-white hate group. So this is the background. I mean, Ali is under a microscope. People are criticizing him, and then suddenly his draft status has changed, and so now he's going to be eligible for the draft, and he's claiming that he is a minister for the Nation of Islam, therefore exempt from the draft. So this was a time that was heated in America, where suddenly the worlds of boxing and the worlds of politics became intertwined, where the world of race entered into the entire picture. So it was an ugly mood for the nation in February 6, 1967, when Ernie Terrell and Muhammad Ali fought in the Astrodome. Mm. And the fight really revolved around the idea of the name Cassius Clay. Ernie Terrell knew Cassius Clay as Cassius Clay earlier in their career, and they were friends. They had sparred together. They had even shared a hotel room together for a while. But when the fight was signed, Ernie Terrell called Muhammad Ali then Clay, and Cassius said, "My name is Muhammad Ali." And Ernie Terrell thought, "Well, okay, but if I keep calling him Cassius Clay, it will be good for promotion, for publicity, for the fight." But it really bothered Muhammad Ali to be called what he considered a slave name. And so that even exasperated the ugly mood surrounding the fight.
What do we know about Ernie Terrell? Where is he at in his career at that time?
Ernie Terrell's doing great in his career. He hadn't lost a fight in about 5 years. He's the number one contender. He holds a portion of the heavyweight championship, and I won't go into that because it's way too complicated. but he's considered having a legitimate chance to beat Muhammad Ali. Not a great chance, but a legitimate chance. Ali called him the octopus because Ernie Terrell was a tall fighter, 6'6", and his style was the kind of paw and grab, paw and hold. And so Muhammad Ali called him the octopus. Ali had a nickname for everybody he fought.
So the days up to the fight, this is in Houston?
This fight's in the Astrodome in Houston, yes.
Okay. So the days up to that, how heated does it get? And is that dialogue back and forth between the fighters largely surrounded on this name, or is it also surrounded on their abilities? What are the days before like?
Well, it really revolves around who is Cassius Clay Cassius Clay, or is he Muhammad Ali? And when the more Terrell refused to call Muhammad Ali, or call Cassius Clay Muhammad Ali, the more angry Muhammad became. And Ali at one point says, "I want to torture him." You know, he's not going into the fight just to win. He's going into the fight as a religious crusade, as a Muslim crusade. He wants to punish Ernie Terrell. He wants to hurt him. He wants to torture him. He wants to make him suffer. He wants to force Ernie Terrell to call him Muhammad Ali. And when they get in the ring, this is exactly what Muhammad Ali does. He will torture. He will He's not interested in knocking him out. He's interested in inflicting pain. And as he's punching, as he's tearing Ernie Terrell apart, he keeps saying, "What's my name? What's my name? What's my name?"
The fight doesn't get called, though.
No, the fight goes the full distance. Now, the problem is that early in the fight, Ernie Terrell's eye was hurt. Now, Terrell claims that Clay intentionally stuck his thumb several times into Terrell's eyes. Muhammad Ali was not a dirty fighter, and Muhammad Ali said, yes, I wanted to punish him, but I would never do that to anybody. So my guess is he didn't, but it affected the vision of Ernie Terrell. It broke a bone in one of his optic bones, and it made him see double, and so he was incapacitated. I mean, he wasn't sure which of the Muhammad Ali he should be throwing punches at, and so he suffered terribly. And the reporters at the fight, and I knew a number of the reporters at the fight, said that, you know, there's no question about it. This was Muhammad Ali at his cruelest, at his most evil, at his most vicious. It was an ugly fight. Jimmy Cannon, a respected sports writer at the time, called it a lynching.
And so is boxing that vicious at the time, too, or is this unusual even for the sport of boxing? Was there a sort of an ethic to it that Muhammad Ali is violating at this point, or is it all part of the sport?
Well, the sport of boxing is a tough sport. There's no question right. about it. And you win by obviously hurting your opponent and incapacitating your opponent. But fighters would say they don't intentionally try to hurt somebody. I mean, it is part of the game, but you can go beyond. I mean, dirty fighting, keeping your opponent going just to inflict pain, which Ali had done before against Floyd Patterson, that almost overstepped the lines of what we would call sportsmanship in boxing. And there certainly is an element of sportsmanship in boxing. And Muhammad Ali probably went beyond that.
How does the nation, you know, we look at it today and we think of pay-per-view and things like that. How is the nation watching this fight?
It's watching it on TV. At this time, Wide World Sports and ABC would oftentimes televise big fights. And so most Americans would be seeing a fight of this caliber. Some of the fights were pay-per-view television, where you would go to a movie theater and see the fight. The Sonny Liston-Muhammad Ali fight was like that. Other fights, Cleveland Williams, Zora Foley, that Ali fought, were on television.
So what happens after the fight? Then, so it's a unanimous decision at the end. And what does Ernie Terrell go on to do next?
Well, Ernie Terrell continues to fight. He has some losses. His career probably never recovered. And eventually, by the end of his life, you know, he suffered some dementia from boxing. More importantly, on April 26, 1967, also in Houston, Texas, Ali faced his induction ceremony. And when his name was called, he refused to step forward to be inducted into the United States Army, which immediately ended his boxing career for several years while the courts litigated on whether he could do that or couldn't do that, whether he had to serve or whether he had an exemption.
So he's what, 25 at this time, in the peak of his career?
Yep, born in 1942, so he's 25 years old. So he's going to lose, what, 3 or so years from the prime of his career, where he will not be able to fight, where he takes what he believes was a moral stand against having to fight in Vietnam.
So put that into context then for the nation, because he's certainly not the only American who's taking a moral stand against Vietnam. What does that elevate him to, a different, a different persona outside of sports?
Not initially. Initially, he's stripped of his title. Most Americans at this time, we're still in 1967, have not really turned strongly against the war in Vietnam yet. That won't take place for another year. And so he's excoriated by most Americans. He's labeled as, if not a coward, he's labeled as anti-American. He's extremely controversial. But over the next 2 or 3 years, as Americans, more and more Americans turn against the war in Vietnam and come to question America's position in Vietnam, then suddenly Muhammad Ali becomes somewhat of a patron saint for the anti-war crusade.
And how does he respond to that controversy then? What does he do next?
Well, he embraces it. Okay. Eventually, of course, his case will go all the way up to the Supreme Court. Initially, he's tried, he's convicted, he's sentenced to prison. He never goes to prison. He's out while it's under appeal. But eventually, it goes to the Supreme Court, and on a technicality, the Supreme Court will reverse his conviction, and it helps make Muhammad Ali who he is today. He's not viewed as a boxer as much as a political figure, a figure who takes stands on controversial issues. He will bring together the worlds of sports and politics in a way that no previous athlete had done.
Does he fight during that time off at all? Is he not allowed to fight during that 3 or so years that he's
has his license taken?
So he sits it out entirely?
Right. He fights one more time in March, I believe, against Zora Foley after the Ernie Terrell fight. And then in April, when he refuses to take a stand, he's stripped from his title. His passport is confiscated. He's not allowed out of the country. He's not allowed to fight. And so he will fight no championship fights until 1970.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Randy Roberts. He teaches history at Purdue University, and he's the co-author of a book called Blood Brothers, The Fatal Friendship Between Muhammad Ali and Malcolm X. And February 6th, 1967, 50 years ago today, is the date of his Muhammad Ali's famous fight against challenger Ernie Terrell. And Randy Roberts, I'm wondering from your book, what is that friendship between Ali and Malcolm X and the impact of it?
Well, it had a tremendous impact on race relations in America. The friendship is that Malcolm X is the one who tutored Muhammad Ali in the Nation of Islam, became his mentor, his deep friend, his spiritual counselor. But yet, the book talks about how eventually Muhammad Ali turns against him, and you know, a year after Ali wins the title, Malcolm X is going to be assassinated by members of the Nation of Islam. And it's how that relationship sours, what happens, how this friendship turns into animosity, and how it finally culminates in the assassination of Malcolm X.
And the legacy of that fight itself and the taunting and the cruelty, you know, how did that sort of resonate in boxing going forward?
Well, it gave Americans a sense of how Ali would treat people who seemed to oppose him on religious grounds or refused to call Muhammad Ali. It's the same sort of tactics he used against Floyd Patterson, and then even more famously against Joe Frazier, when he called Joe Frazier a gorilla, and he called Joe Frazier an Uncle Tom, and he said Joe Frazier was ugly. It shows maybe a little bit of the meaner side of Muhammad Ali.
Fascinating stuff. Randy Roberts, co-author of Blood Brothers, The Fatal Friendship Between Muhammad Ali and Malcolm X. He teaches history at Purdue. Randy, thank you so much for being with us here today.
That's great. It was great talking to you, Laurie.
Welcome back to In the Moment. Timothy McVeigh was deeply influenced by the literature and ideas of a radical right political movement. On April 19, 1995, he parked a truck with a 5-ton fertilizer bomb in front of the Alfred P. Murrow Federal Building in Oklahoma City. The blast killed 168 people, including 19 children, and injured 675. The American Experience documentary Oklahoma City airs on SDPB-TV Tuesday, February 4th at 8 p.m. Sorry, I got that date wrong. Tomorrow night, Tuesday, 8 p.m. Central, 7 p.m. Mountain. And today we welcome film producer Barrick Goodman from Brooklyn, New York. Barrick, welcome to In the Moment.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this is a history lesson that doesn't really begin on April 19th. It begins before Waco, before Ruby Ridge. We go back to maybe, how far do you want to go back? To Bob Matthews? Do you want to explain who this character is and how he kind of comes onto the scene?
Sure. In the late 70s, early 80s, there began to be contact between a lot of disparate far-right white supremacist groups. They would meet at a place called Aryan Nations, which is in Idaho. And out of this kind of congress of white supremacists, a splinter group arose called the Order, which was run by a guy, led by a guy named Bob Matthews. And the whole point of the Order was to sort of turn words into action and to create a paramilitary terrorist force on the far right, whose design was to bring down the federal government. And this was sort of the first time we'd seen organized domestic terrorism on the far right, as we'd seen in the 60s on the far left.
What are they angry about? And why are they angry at the federal government? Why is that the target?
Those are very, very good questions. You know, there's a lot of grievances here. I think what we say in the film is that, generally speaking, there was a kind of feeling among certain people that the federal government had been infiltrated, to use their words, by Jews and people of color, and that the sort of white supremacist prerogatives in this country were disappearing. Some of the leaders of this movement even went harking back to the Civil War as sort of the beginning of the end of the sort of white dominance and white supremacy. Why did it happen at this particular moment? A lot of factors, one of which was the farm crisis that happened in the late 70s and early 80s, dispossessed a lot of farmers. And one of those farmers actually was Randy Weaver, who ended up in the middle of the Ruby Ridge standoff.
Federal agencies starting to take notice of the Order and pay attention to it at this point?
Very slowly. There was literally one FBI agent detailed to look at this group when it first began doing its spree of crimes in the Pacific Northwest. But once there was a Denver talk show host, a Jewish talk show host named Alan Berg, who was murdered in Denver. Once that happened, more and more attention began to be paid to what was then just a kind of very nascent, kind of very early forming movement. And as time went on, as the Ruby Ridge thing happened, certainly with Waco, you saw more and more law enforcement attention being paid to these groups.
So we're going to ask all these big questions today, but let's go to Ruby Ridge and just say, in a nutshell, what goes wrong there?
Well,
how does it become politicized at that point, too?
It does. It's really one of those real head-scratching tragedies. It was so avoidable. I mean, here was a family really just flirtation with white supremacist, white separatist ideas. They'd moved to Idaho mostly out of religious conviction that Armageddon was coming and they needed a place to hide out, a mountaintop lair or retreat. But Randy Weaver, the father in the family, had sort of some contact with Aryan Nations, and he was noticed there by the FBI, who thought they could turn him into an informant. But his deep suspicion of the government prevented that. And so after a sting operation went wrong, he retreated to his cabin with his family. And for some reason, the FBI and the U.S. Marshals kind of began to lump him in with this white supremacist paramilitary, sort of movement, even though he really wasn't part of it. And so they treated him that way. They surrounded his cabin. A shootout happened. His son was killed, and a federal marshal was killed. And once that happened, the whole thing ramped up and kind of went out of control. What was most distressing about that story is that the FBI issued essentially a shoot-to-kill order against the family, which resulted in the death of Vicki Weaver, Randy's wife. And that order was clearly illegal. It really inflamed and kind of almost proved to the far right everything that they'd been thinking and talking about the federal government.
Now, throughout this documentary, it's called Oklahoma City. If you're just joining us, we're talking to Barrett Goodman, one of the film's producers, and you can see it tomorrow night on SDPB-TV at 8 p.m. Central, 7 Mountain. And, Barrett, one of the things that happens throughout this two-hour film is this weaving in of scenes after the explosion at the Alfred P. Murrow Building and then going into history a little bit. So let's talk for a minute about once the moment the bomb goes off and talking to survivors and people, first responders. Tell me, What was the impact of that bomb, and what was the rescue operation like?
The bomb was absolutely shocking to the nation in a way that it's hard to recapture now because we've been through so much since then with terrorism. But it was the first, you know, for a lot of people, it was the first glimpse of what a terrorist act really looked like. We'd seen sort of glimpses of it in the African embassy bombings and Lebanon barracks bombing, but this was on our home soil. That image of the sort of whole face of the building being sheared away. And then, of course, the revelation that it wasn't a Middle Eastern terrorist, as everyone had assumed, including law enforcement, but it was actually one of us. It was one of our own homegrown, you know, clean-cut kids who'd been in the army. Those shocks really reverberated, resonated deeply in the American psyche. And I think, you know, we really wanted to bring that back. So we do spend a lot of time in the film, you know, in Oklahoma City, in that building, in the hours after the explosion, with the people who were trapped there, who were trying to get people out of there. And then in the immediate few days after with the investigation, as it very quickly ended up pointing to Timothy McVeigh.
Mm. And there's a daycare. And I think everyone remembers that. Right. Did Timothy McVeigh know there was a daycare in that building?
That's a controversial question. He always denied it, even after he, you know, was in prison and convicted and on death row. He gave a series of jailhouse interviews in which he denied knowing there was a daycare. But a lot of people think it was, you know, he cased the building before he blew it up. And people who know that building, knew that building, say it was pretty hard to miss. It was on the second floor and there were little cutouts and little, you know, childish drawings up on the windows, and you really would have had to kind of purposely look away to miss it. But whether or not he knew there was a daycare, he when confronted with that fact, you know, when he was on death row, his response was, "They're collateral damage in an ongoing war, and I'm sorry, but the parents should get over it." That's literally what he said. So whether or not he knew there was one, he had absolutely no remorse, no compunction about what he'd done, killing 16 children.
So let's continue this path that sort of develops Timothy McVeigh into the person that he becomes, and go to Waco, Texas, and talk about Branch Davidians, David Koresh. They're not white supremacists. What's the connection between them and Ruby Ridge? Timothy McVeigh's mind, yeah.
Very direct connection. Well, there are a couple of connections. First of all, many of the very same FBI agents who were at Ruby Ridge come down to Waco. It's the hostage rescue team is deployed. It's the same set of actors, very aggressive, very tactical, very militaristic. For McVeigh, though, it was the spectacle of what he regarded as, you know, sort of innocent Americans surrounded by an evil, malevolent federal force. He believed, and so did many on the far right, that despite the fact that the Davidians weren't white supremacists themselves, they were gun lovers. They were people who were defying the federal government. They were people who believed the federal government was what they call Babylon, was kind of corrupt and evil. And so they adopted them essentially as part of their own movement, and this standoff and this tragedy were more proof to the far right, the extremist right, that the federal government was a force out of control, bent on the destruction of you know, the rights of American citizens. So McVeigh actually went down to Waco in the middle of the standoff, almost to pay homage, almost as a pilgrimage. And these two events, Ruby Ridge and Waco, really are the events that radicalized Tim McVeigh and put him on a path towards the bombing.
He's selling bumper stickers.
Right. He goes right. down to sell bumper stickers.
Yeah. He's a little pop-up shop there on his car, and he's selling bumper stickers to folks as he sort of pays homage as well.
And weirdly, there's a camera crew that captures a few seconds of video of him. Just they didn't know who he was, obviously, just a guy there, and they happened to kind of interview him, and we have that footage, and it's chilling to see him down there when you know that only 2 years later he would do what he did.
Is American law enforcement prepared for a shift in thinking at this point? They seem they seem unprepared, and they lose federal agents at Waco as well. You see them carrying, I mean, they're carrying off injured people on the hoods of cars and carrying their own dead agents away from Waco in a firefight that lasts like two and a half hours or something at first before the long standoff. It's a wreck, right?
It's a total debacle. It really is hard to understand. It really is. It's not the FBI initially. It's the ATF, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, who raids the Branch Davidian complex. They meant to do it as a kind of surprise raid, but the Branch Davidians were tipped off, and it turns into the really one of the worst debacles in law enforcement history. There are four ATF agents are killed, many more are wounded gravely, and five Davidians are killed in this botched raid, which never had to happen. It didn't have to happen that way. And then once that happened, you had dead federal agents. The FBI descends in force again. And this time they're a little bit more patient. They wait 51 days. But at the end of 51 days, with really few options left, they decide to go in with gas, as everyone might remember, to try to smoke out the Davidians. And the Davidians end up setting fire to their compound and committing mass suicide. And again, you know, the FBI is left looking like murderers. And, you know, they haven't really learned their lessons. It is only after Waco that the FBI really changes the way it handles itself in these kinds of situations. But by that point, so many people are angry and upset at them that it's kind of almost too late.
So Timothy McVeigh is not the only person who's disturbed or, I don't want to use the word inspired, but, you know, spurred on to some action maybe after Waco, after Ruby Ridge. But he's the only person who creates a truck bomb and takes it to Oklahoma City. What is it? What do we know about his past and his upbringing that sort of changes that ideology to where he'll act on it in the way that he did?
It's a great question, and kind of one of the eternal mysteries of any sort of mass murder is why this person, why did this person step out of the crowd and commit himself to this action? I think it's a combination, obviously, a whole complex of forces. McVeigh himself is a very bright guy, but totally estranged from his family, isolated, had very few friends, no relationships, no girlfriends or wife. He had a sense of himself as kind of a grand historical figure, someone who was destined to do something big, but he lived a very pathetically small life. He was on that kind of traveling gun show circuit, kind of eking out a living, trading and selling guns. And he just kind of shrunk into a narrower and narrower world, a smaller and smaller bubble with other people who believed as he did. Yet there still is that question of why him? And I guess that will always remain something of a mystery. You know, you can't, there are a lot of people who fit a profile, but then only one goes ahead and does it. And lots of money and many smarter people than me look into why that is. And yet I don't think there's any perfect formula for understanding it.
You talk to, in this film, there are many first responders and people who survived, parents whose children survived, parents who lost their children. How is this looking to them through the lens of history? How do they sort of, you know, carry this day with them still?
The reactions and the sort of aftermath have varied a lot for the parents. There's some parents who just will not go there. They just won't speak about it. They don't want to be in public. They don't want to revisit it. And I totally understand that and empathize with that. And then there are a set of parents who've really try to turn it somehow, not into a positive, but to find something redeeming about it, to find a way to turn their tragedy into something positive in the world. And one who immediately leaps to mind is in our film. Her name is Helena Garrett. She's a young African-American mother at the time of the bombing who loses her one-year-old son. And we got to know Helena quite well. She's incredibly articulate, incredibly strong. She came to our screening at Sundance not having seen the film, and she saw it for the first time with an audience there, which I thought was by itself very brave. And she got up and she gave this incredibly riveting, you know, everybody in the house was sobbing by the end of it, just this sort of speech about how she was determined to use this tragedy to bring peace and love and harmony to the world. And and how this was all done in the name of Kevin. And, you know, to find people like that is the one really positive thing for me personally in doing this film. It was a fascinating film to work on. It was an incredibly interesting puzzle to put together. But in terms of, like, you know, hope and redemption and love, it's people like Helena and others at Oklahoma City that really made it worth doing for me.
It had to be draining for you as well. There has to be an emotional toll from making the film, too, in some ways. Not to overstate compared to, you know, what the people in the film went through, but it's a real thing as well, yes?
In a way, it was. Yes, yeah, sure. I mean, being in, with this footage, graphic footage, day in and day out, and trying to kind of be in the mind of someone like this. We had 60 hours of jailhouse interviews done with McVeigh that I had to kind of wade through, and it's very unpleasant to be inside that kind of a person's mind, and yet you want to try to understand him, and so you can, you know, you can bring him to life and make him three-dimensional. But, you know, very little redeeming about Timothy McVeigh himself, who, as I said before, had not an ounce of remorse in him. So that was a little bit trying, but overall, I mean, I love history and I love the process of connecting dots and unearthing a deeper story behind the story we think we know. And in that sense, this was an incredibly, you know, fruitful enterprise. Hmm.
The film is called Oklahoma City. It airs tomorrow night on SDPB-TV, 8 p.m. Central, 7 Mountain. Our guest has been one of the filmmakers, Barrick Goodman. Barrick, thank you so much for being with us here. It's a powerful documentary.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Independent Lens brings you Birth of a Movement tonight on SDPB-TV. The documentary looks at the controversial film The Birth of a Nation and its legacy, including how it influenced a generation of African-American filmmakers and artists to reclaim their history and images on screen. Our guest today is one of the film's directors, Bester Cram, who joins us from Boston. Bester Cram, welcome to In the Moment.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.
Let's start with some of our main characters for this film, and let's begin with William Monroe Trotter. Who is he?
William Monroe Trotter is a man who actually has sort of disappeared from public view in terms of people understanding his role in history. He is a radical newspaper man who was actually the first African-American to graduate Phi Beta Kappa from Harvard University back in 1893. And upon his graduation, after a period of time as in real estate, he founded a newspaper called The Guardian, which became a voice both of the black community in Boston, but also a editorial voice of various different black concerns throughout the country. And in particular, he was taking on Booker T. Washington and providing an alternative view in which he felt the issues facing the African-American community ought to be concerned about.
And what are some of those major differences that he has with Booker T. for Washington, for example?
Well, good question. Major differences had to do with actually full citizenship. Mm-hmm. A willingness to essentially overcome what Booker T. Washington had done, which he had done actually quite successfully, which was to organize the black community, but not to be a threat to the white community in terms of upsetting sort of the Jim Crow laws that had been set in place. And I think Monroe Trotter understood very accurately that segregation and separate but equal was just not going to be a world that blacks would want to live in. And so he took that on, and he also became a very strong voice in helping set up the NAACP up at a place called the Niagara Movement that first sort of preceded that particular organization. But he was a tough man to get along with.
Yeah.
He was an independent sort, as oftentimes radical voices are. And so he departed from the NAACP at its founding, whereas his colleague from Harvard, W.E.D. Du Bois, continued on with that organization. Of course, Monroe Trotter's biggest difficulty with that organization was that it was oftentimes populated by a lot of and led by a lot of white people. And Trotter felt that if the NAACP was going to succeed, it had to be led in by the black community.
He seems very forward-thinking, maybe ahead of his time a little bit.
I think that's why this film coming out at this particular time is important, because, yes, he was an avatar. He was also willing to take a stand. He wasn't just a newspaper man expressing his opinion in print. He actually marched and protested and created direct action as a form of protest, meaning he was willing to be confrontational.
I want to get to that in a little bit deeper context here in a minute, but I feel like we should pick up D.W. Griffith and the film itself, Birth of a Nation. Can you describe that film and D.W. Griffith's, what he brought to it and why he brought it to the screen?
Well, D.W. Griffith is historically one of the most important filmmakers in this nation and in the world community of filmmaking. He understood that the idea of making motion pictures into an art form was something that needed to be explored, and he had a very grand sense of what that could be. He was an actor originally, and then he began to direct and produce short silent films. But it was when he actually made a connection with Thomas Dixon, the author of a book called The Klansman, that he used as his blueprint for making a feature film. And this feature film was a grand story of the Civil War and a grand story of post-Reconstruction. But it was a view that was not necessarily an accurate historical view. It was a view that he wanted to promote, which was a view also that Thomas Dixon was very much interested in, which essentially was trying to think of the U.S. Historically as a nation that needed to return to pre-Civil War ideals and values. Mm-hmm. And D.W. Griffith chose the medium of film to make this 3.5-hour epic. He invented many different techniques, or he certainly promoted a lot of technical techniques in terms of storytelling that endure today, that make him such a famous filmmaker. But it was the fact that he also understood the power of image that makes him such a detested filmmaker, in that he created images that are stereotypes that continue to be lasting in some respect in terms of the world that we encounter today, that were derogatory and just terribly offensive, particularly to the black community.
And this is really interesting, because there's a lot of film history in this documentary. And if you're just tuning in, we're talking about Birth of a Movement, which you can see tonight on SDPB-TV. Our guest is Bester Cram. He's one of the film's directors. And in this, you sort of start with these early motion picture Nickelodeons, and there's a certain amount of equality here, and then you get to projected films, and it shifts. Why that shift from, you know, dancers of all races sort of being portrayed in the Nickelodeons equally, and then all of a sudden you have these stereotypes projected in film?
Well, I think the shift is hard to explain, other than it coincided at the same time that Plessy versus Ferguson, which was the legal case that went to the courts, enabling separate but equal to be the law of the land. And once that had been articulated and presented and accepted, it essentially reinforced a notion that permeated a great deal of the white population in America at that particular time. And so films begin to reflect the stereotypes and the fears.
Let's go to Boston, because that's another character really in this film. The film premieres, the Birth of a Nation film, I'm talking about, premieres in Los Angeles, 1915, and then it starts making its way to Boston. And Boston is an interesting place with an interesting dynamic right now. Put that into context for me.
Well, Boston was a place that was well known for a mayor, James Michael Curley, who supposedly felt like he had his hand on the pulse of what was considered to be a proper way for art to be expressive of social values. And he had, in the past, shut down certain plays because he considered them to be too risque or to not be in the public interest, including the play called The Klansman, which was the film Birth of a Nation was actually based on. And so there was an expectation on the part of D.W. Griffith when he brought his movie, which originally was called The Klansman and then had been changed to The Birth of a Nation. There was an expectation on his part that he was going to meet with some opposition in Boston. But if he could get through Boston, he could then show this film around the world, certainly around the rest of the country. He had already met opposition in Los Angeles when he first opened it. He then went to Washington, D.C., where he got the endorsement of the president, Woodrow Wilson, and then opened it up in New York. There was opposition in New York, but it certainly it was not strong enough to shut down the film. So it comes to Boston, and this is where D.W. Griffith and Monroe Trotter first encounter each other in person.
One of your guests in this film, I think his name is Vincent Brown, professor, I forget the university that he's from, he uses the word racial pornography and then explains really what is wrong with these stereotypes and D.W. Griffith's just mastery of putting fear on the screen for audience members. So let's talk about that for a little bit. What did Griffith understand about paying audiences that he really sort of manipulated and capitalized? And then sort of define this notion of racial pornography to me.
Boy, that's a good question, really complicated to delve into. Vincent Brown, who's an absolutely marvelous professor of history and of media culture at Harvard University.
Harvard, okay.
I think he understood, in terms of the way in which he described what D.W. Griffith understood, was that the core interest that we as an audience have in art, and particularly in terms of what motion pictures could possibly do, would be to essentially isolate ourselves with certain emotional experiences. And that if you really played into those emotional experiences, this was how you were going to both persuade an audience to accept a particular narrative and to essentially want to have more and more of it come at you. Now, when he uses the word racial pornography, basically what he's suggesting here is that D.W. Griffith chose stereotypical images of African-American population as a way in which to essentially further the narrative, but also to further the emotional response of an audience in terms of its fear and to exploit all of the ideas that are essentially found in various different forms, whether they're in print or in cartoons or in paintings or whatever, that exploit essentially a stereotype of an African American. And I think Vincent Brown speaks very clearly about how this becomes pornography, because what it does is you throw up the image and the image becomes now the image that is accepted and believed. It's kind of promoting a stereotype that stirs the emotion in one particular way or another. The pornographic part of it, of course, has to do with the fact that it's completely invalid. And in some respects, it's exploitive and creates a kind of a lasting impression that has nothing to do with anything that is actually real, other than it is an idea that is being purported by a particular individual, or in this instance, by what is coming out in this film.
Yeah, We just have a couple minutes left, and when we talk about that, I have never seen Birth of a Nation, but as I saw the clips, and the film is just masterful at including film history in, and the guests are so insightful and eloquent. It's just something to really tune into. Gender came across, too, as something that I noticed when they talk about fear. There's always these women who are either being attacked by, black men, ravaging white women, and that's the great fear. And then in the end, you have sort of this response where it's a white slave owner attacking a black female. And I'm just wondering if, could you make a whole nother movie looking at the gender implications of that film as well?
Well, I think you've reached to sort of the core problem with Birth of a Nation is the miscegenation that it's so much is about. And yes, I think there are more films to be made that kind of explore these particular issues. I think they're at the core of a lot of cinema today, in which people are trying to understand the notion of sexual assault and its historical origins that place genders in different power roles, and then you add on to that the issues of race and how that becomes an extension of the violence that is perpetrated against of one population against another.
Mr. Cram, we're going to have to stop there. We could go on for another hour, but please tune in to Birth of a Movement tonight, SDPB-TV. Bester, thank you so much for this film, and thanks for being with us today.
Thanks very much. I enjoyed talking with you.